Hi, everybody. Today is Tuesday, April 22nd, 2025, and our friend Graham Fuller is back with us. Welcome back, Graham.
Thank you, Nima. A pleasure.
Graham, how do you see the situation between the United States and Iran? On one hand, you have the United States and Iran, the second round of negotiations and talks. They're talking about that the overall situation between the two countries is positive, and they're trying to make some sort of agreement. But you see, Israel is doing everything just to avoid that. Donald Trump today tweeted that he's on the same page with Netanyahu. He had a phone call with Netanyahu. He's on the same page with Netanyahu. How do you see the way that Donald Trump, you look at his administration, he's full of Zionists, but you don't see that much of resistance on the part of Netanyahu to go after him, as we saw it during the Obama administration, if you remember that. What's going on, in your opinion?
Well, several things are going on. First of all, you're absolutely right that Trump has appointed lots of Zionists to his administration and in close circles to his foreign policy. But I've also thought that perhaps there was an element of cleverness to this, in the sense that these people are now working for Trump. And if they don't do what Trump says, and he's getting tougher about it. He complained in his last administration that the people he appointed to being foreign minister and things of that sort did not obey what he wanted and went off on their own agendas. So this time, you know, if Marco Rubio doesn't like it, Trump's going to fire him. I think he understands that. And I assume that Marco Rubio would rather be foreign minister, even if he has to do what Trump wants, than to lose that position. But secondly, you're right. I mean, the pressure, there are two main pressures on Trump. One is his desire really to be the man of peace that I take fairly seriously. It would be a great victory for him if he is able to pull off some kind of reconciliation and restoration of relations and improvement of these nuclear situations. He might get a Nobel Prize for that, and that's great. He would deserve it. So I think he's partly motivated by that. And when Rubio says, Rubio on other things says that the U.S. can walk away, I don't believe any of this. I think almost everything Trump says is tactical. We'll see. But the other pressure is, of course, the Zionist influence in the U.S. and Netanyahu. But we've seen, you may remember a couple of months back, I said, if I were Bibi, I would not trust Trump. And I think we see that increasingly, that there's been some unpleasant surprises in Bibi, even in the White House itself. When Bibi came and Trump said that actually the solution to the Gaza problem would be that America would take it over. I think that took Netanyahu by great surprise. And then recently, Trump waited until Bibi was in the White House when he announced that he was going to reopen relations open talks with Iran, serious talks. And that cannot be what Netanyahu wanted to hear. So there are lots of forces at work, and some of them canceling each other out. I don't think anybody can actually fully predict where it's going to go. But I'm encouraged that I think both Iran and Trump would like to reach an agreement. The Europeans may be troublemakers, for all I know. We don't know yet.
What makes the difference between the conflict, the negotiations between the United States and Russia in Ukraine, and the negotiations between the United States and Iran? It seems that with the case of Iran, both parties are totally in favor of putting an end to the negotiation and getting some sort of outcome agreement as soon as possible, which doesn't seem that would be the case for what's going on in Ukraine, because it seems, do you think that conflict in Ukraine is getting much more complicated, or we are so optimistic about what's going on between Iran and the United States?
I think the situation in Iran is politically very complicated. Militarily, it does not seem to be complicated at all. And I think that is what Russia views as its main advantage and leverage in this situation, is that it is moving forward bit by bit, carefully, every day. It is growing stronger. Ukraine is growing weaker. It's lacking weapons. Even if the Europeans, who like to talk big in the event, even if they did everything that they've said they want to do, you know, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Finland, all of this stuff, I think a lot of this, it may be talk, or it may be a sign that they're looking towards a more independent Europe down the road. But the fact is, there's no way Sweden and Norway and Denmark and Finland are going to be able to turn this battlefield around anytime soon within meaningful discussion period. So the battlefield is still probably the most significant factor of all. I think Europe, especially the UK, which is playing a very negative role, typically a very negative role in all of this, Europe is complicating the problem, but I don't think Europe has much to offer. And what's different is that it's even more important than Iran, if you don't mind my saying so, in the sense that this would be a settlement in Ukraine would be putting an end to a 50-year-old Cold War, and possibly opening the way to an extraordinary new security, pan-European security agreement, which meets everyone's security needs, and not just NATO or not just Russia. So I think the stakes and the importance of the negotiations in Ukraine are much more important even than Iran. And Iran is important because it obviously even involves Russian issues as well.
When you hear that Europeans are just gathering together in small groups and making some sort of military agreements, do you think that in the eyes of Europeans, the importance of NATO is diminishing? And what do they feel, in your opinion, in that case?
To me, there's no question that the importance of NATO is diminishing, certainly in U.S. eyes, or let's say Trump's eyes, which is what really matters. If Trump and the U.S. through the U.S., if the U.S. through Trump decides that it's not going to work closely with NATO anymore, that's the end of NATO functionally. The Europeans may be able to pull together some kind of European security. That might not be all bad. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be extremely hostile towards Russia, although the present leaderships in Europe are, I think, very hostile to Russia. But that's going to change, I think, even with elections coming. I don't think most average Europeans want war with Russia. It's not in their advantage. So, I think Europe is still thrashing around, trying to figure out who they are, what they want to be, where do they want to go, what will the cost be, and how to think about being an independent force. It's, the Europeans have essentially been, I don't want to be insulting, but I mean, essentially they've been children taken care of by a great power. Don't worry yourselves about, you know, European security. We'll take care of all of that. Just look after your own domestic programs, and that's good. The times have changed, and Europe now has to consider what it's like to be acting as a fully adult actor in the world without the United States. And I think they're struggling for identity. European identities may be becoming looser, maybe becoming less cohesive. You could say that's very bad, but I think, I think it's unfortunate. If it takes a big enemy to keep the Europeans together, they should have better reasons to work together than simply a common enemy, and especially an enemy that we're not sure really should be an enemy in the long term.
Recently, Donald Trump said the European Union was created just in order to benefit from us, from the United States. In what sense he's talking about the European Union is benefiting from the United States? Because we have been talking about, many people believe that the European Union was created in order to make some sort of advantage for the United States, to somehow manage the policies, considering the European Union and not dealing with each and every country in Europe, but dealing with the European Union, which would be some people who are not that much, they don't need to get votes from the public opinion. And how do you see who's benefiting from the other? Is the way that Donald Trump is picturing the situation, or the way that many people believe that the United States is benefiting from Europe?
I think politically the United States is benefiting from the present constellation of the EU, particularly because the EU, through not particularly democratic processes, has brought into power a lot of real hawks, and especially the Ursula von der Leyen, who is sort of the unofficial president, who is a true hawk, a dangerous woman in my opinion. And she went ahead and appointed the foreign minister of the EU as being from Kaja Kallas, I think her name is, I forget her full name. Anyway, she's Estonian, and Estonians are guaranteed. Pardon me?
Kaja Kallas.
Kaja Kallas, exactly. Ukraine, Estonians are guaranteed to be anti-Russian until the end of time. It's just a fact of life that if you're a very small nation with maybe 30, 40% population Russian, and you're right next to Russia, you're going to be nervous forever. So in that sense, I think through one reason or another, the EU has become a more anti-Russian instrument than it might have been in the past. And I think maybe it's facilitated US ability to pressure the EU, manipulate it to its own ends than it has in the past. I don't know even how truly strong the economic bonds among European states are, but it looks like they're not so, maybe not so strong, and more politically powerful than economically powerful. Good question, though.
When you look at Europe, and even the concept of NATO was created because of Warsaw Pact, Soviet Union, communists, all of these things that they were talking about in those days. But right now there is no Soviet Union. There is no communist Russia. And even Russia is not interested. It's interested in economic ties with Europe, not in any sort of other, as they're trying to picture Russia, they're going to attack us and all of that nonsense. We know that. But with the case of China, it would be the same. China is not going to attack anybody. But do you think when it comes to Russia, do they really need NATO? Do they really, what is the benefit of European Union? Is that going to be beneficial for Europe to be independent, or it's going to be the opposite way? They're not going to benefit from the European Union if they decide to be independent from the United States.
Well, the beginning of your question was addressed to the NATO issue. I think NATO is has been the premier instrument of the United States in being able to direct, push, pressure, influence the European states. And so if NATO disappears, in one sense, that does remove some degree of U.S. leverage over Europe. I think in Trump's case, he's betting that maybe there is not a need for a big defense budget against Russia. But this is a very serious question, Niemann. I don't want to dismiss it. I have many arguments personally with friends when I say, look, Russia is not going to attack. I have some Polish friends, I think if you're German, you have no fear that Russia is going to attack you. But if you're Polish, you might have some concerns if you look back at the history. Both Russia and Poland have attacked each other back and forth over the border for several hundred years, and it hasn't been just Russia. It's been two-way street. So I think there are good grounds to believe that Russia will not seek to expand. For one thing, now there are lots of military forces from NATO present. But I think it's almost a question now of faith and political philosophy as to whether you think Russia is inherently aggressive. I do not think it is inherently aggressive, and I think the post-World War II settlement now is fairly permanent. But then people say, okay, but what about Ukraine then? How do you explain Ukraine? Then you get into the argument of, well, who started the Ukraine war? Was it US and NATO pushing right up to Russia's boundaries? That would be my argument. But you cannot deny the fact that Russia was the force that did attack, whatever the reason. So there's less confidence among hawks or conservatives in Europe in saying, oh, don't worry about Russia, it's not going to do it. That's my opinion. I don't think it will, but I can't prove it. And I acknowledge that there is a legitimate debate here to be had among serious people.
But we have to consider that the world has changed. That's why we have a better relationship between Russia and China. Nobody could have thought of that before. Between Iran, many people that I talk, Iran never thought that they're going to be so close to Russia. And right now they're so close. And this shows how the nature of the situation in that region, in the Eurasia, as we call it, Eurasia, is changing. But what would be the, how Russia would benefit from any sort of attack on Poland? What is in it for Russia? That doesn't make sense, Graham. When you look at China, look at Iran. These were, if we go back, we can find a lot of reason to be the enemy of each other. You have to see what's going on right now. Russia is not the Soviet Union, by the way.
I agree. I'm just pointing out to you that there is some serious legitimate debate among foreign policy specialists about whether Russia is still possibly aggressive or not. I agree with you entirely. And furthermore, yes, you're right. The world has been changing. It's stunning that there are these close ties now between Russia and Iran. You know better than I do that Iran has been invaded repeatedly by Russia over hundreds of years. And if you had to choose natural enemies, say, within that region, you'd say, well, Iran is an enemy of Russia, just as Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, was an enemy of Russia and the Russian Empire. Yes, times change. And also, I think it's the United States that's been the marriage broker, if you will, bringing together Russia and Iran, and then obviously the case of China and Russia as well. I think concern and anxiety in both Russia and China about America's unilateral policies in the past and being a world sole superpower, that has helped push them into each other's arms. That's probably going to be the case for quite some time, I think, but nothing is forever. I'm very encouraged by these new correlation of forces, but obviously Washington is not, and they have only themselves to thank.
Graham, one part of the previous question I asked, it was, how do you see the European Union? Is Europe or European countries, are they going to benefit from the European Union if they decide to go independent, to be more independent from the United States, or the European Union, if they keep this sort of union and just continue being independent, they would benefit better?
I don't think the collapse of NATO would mean automatically the end of the EU by any means. I mean, the EU, as you know, is designed for economic ends, not the political military ends, as is NATO. But I think it would begin to be, it would begin to open up some divisions among Europeans and European nations. I mean, not all Europeans benefit equally from the EU. I mean, you can talk to the Greeks about this, who have had many many complaints about the nature of the EU. A country like Germany obviously hugely dominates the EU economically alone. But I think the EU would continue to exist, but it will have increased pressures upon it. I think they would be very ill-advised to break apart. They need each other to bring greater strength, geopolitical strength, to Europe, which they would lose with the end of NATO, which is one of their concerns about the potential end of NATO. They would lose geopolitical power. Yes, they lose a lot of sovereignty to Washington, for sure. And that bothers some Europeans, I think, who did not want to be dragged into war against Saddam, or did not want to be dragged into war in Afghanistan, or who don't want to be dragged into war even with China, which the U.S. is kind of pushing them, not into war, but into hostilities or an alliance again. So these divisions are going to grow within Europe, especially if NATO is weakened or comes to an end.
Graham, it seems that the United States is trying to somehow shift from Europe to Asia. But in this shift, they're trying to do everything to somehow negotiate with India. Here is what J.D. Vance said in terms of India. I want to know, what's your take and what do they want to do with India in terms of what's going on between the United States and China?
This industry alliance will enable America and India to develop the most state-of-the-art maritime systems needed for victory. It's fitting that India, this year, is hosting the Quad Leaders Summit this fall. Our interests in a free, open, peaceful, and prosperous Indo-Pacific are in full alignment. Both of us know that the region must remain safe from any hostile powers that seek to dominate it. Growing relations between our countries over the last decade are part of what led America to designate India a major defense partner, the first of that class. This designation means that India now shares with the UAE a defense and technology infrastructure and partnership with the United States on par with America's closest allies and friends. But we actually feel that India has much more to gain from its continued defense partnership with the United States, and let me sketch that out a little bit.
Yeah. Well, what's your interpretation of what J.D. Vance is talking about?
Well, for one thing, J.D. Vance's wife is Indian, as you know. So maybe she has some influence over him on this quick question. I don't know whether he would be in India quite so quickly if his wife was not Indian. And that's probably very good. She brings broader perspective to JD himself. But frankly, I find very difficult to swallow what JD Vance is saying. He is trying, obviously, to drive a wedge, a desperate wedge between India and China. I think the U.S. has been trying to do this for a very long time, but I don't think it's going to work. We all know that China and India now have been talking to each other diplomatically under much better circumstances over the last several years. These problems between India and China are not serious problems. I mean, if you want to have problems, okay, you can fight over mountaintops and various, you know, roads through the Himalayas. But this is not the really significant geopolitical stuff in the end. But if you want to make trouble, yes, it's there. But if you decide, look, can't we agree over mountaintops and roads? They will agree. And I think at this point, India feels it is not at an advantage to be having bad relations with China on so many different grounds, economic grounds, military grounds. And also, I don't think India wants to be dragged into a conflict or with on the U.S. side against China. That's not in India's interest. It's not part of India's image, even when you look back at India as the great non-aligned power balancing between them all. I think J.D. Vance, frankly, he's just, I think he's, as we say in English, whistling in the dark, trying to make the best out of a situation that I don't think is particularly positive. Nor will India, I think, side entirely with, certainly will not side with China and Russia against the U.S. That would be very foolish, too. So I suspect that India will play all three sides against each other. Talking about these relations, I mean, India and Russia have had extremely good ties for years and years and years. And the whole oil situation, the embargo on Russian oil, India has been very helpful to Russia. It's been helpful both ways. So I think I just think this is a fairly hopeless enterprise on the part of Washington to bring India into a anti-Chinese bloc. There's just nothing in it for India at all.
If that's the strategy, if they want to shift to Asia to fight with China, let's assume economically, not militarily. Do you think that Donald Trump would do that without solving the conflict in Ukraine and the conflict in the Middle East, or he's going to have all of them together? You know how that would influence, by the way, the strategy, if that's a strategy to shift.
You mean he would push Russia and China and India all together? Well, that's an interesting question you pose, Nima. I suppose it's possible. I think India is going to be very careful, though, in maintaining this balance. As I said, this is part of India's own historical reputation as a balancer. And I don't think, I doubt that there is pressure from the Chinese or even from Russia to take their side against the U.S. They know that India would suffer also from becoming hostile to the U.S. So I think JD may be complaining about, maybe is able to complain about what the new geopolitical realities are in the region, but I don't think he's going to change it. It's exactly as you said earlier. This is part of the new world order that's coming about, and it's more complicated. And the U.S. doesn't like, the U.S. likes to use the word allies. Russia doesn't talk about allies. India doesn't talk about allies. Iran doesn't talk about allies, and even these new relations between India I'm sorry, between Iran and Russia, I don't think anybody's used the word alliance. It's been a partner concept of partnership, which is a little bit different. It's a little less strategic and military. So, yeah, I don't think this is going to change much, and I don't think Trump can change it.
Graham, the nature of the relationship between Iran and Russia, between Russia and China, is somehow similar to the laws that each and every society makes for itself. As the society needs some sort of law because of the current situation of the communication and the sort of relationship between its particles, I'm talking about people. The society needs, because people do need that sort of law. And that then we have lawmakers, they're talking about it. And it seems that in the terms of relationship between Iran and Russia and China, the way that they're behaving is much more advanced than the way that they're talking about treaties and all of that. By the way, I'm talking about, for example, for Russia and Iran. Iran was providing Russia, helping Russia in the war in Ukraine without having any sort of treaty. And really? Later on, they have decided to have a treaty to talk about these things.
I didn't know that, Nima. But I think, hasn't Iran been selling drones to both sides? And Turkey has been selling to both sides.
No, to both sides? No.
Okay.
It was helping Russia without having any sort of treaty.
China
was helping Russia. You've mentioned India was helping Russia without having anything on the paper.
Right.
That's why I'm talking about. That's why when we talk about NATO, can you imagine that the United States goes to war for Montenegro because of something happened to Montenegro? Can you assume that? Can you see? It's not realistic when you look at NATO, for example. But whatever happens between Iran and Russia, China, even India, it's realistic based on what they have, what they face.
Well, it sounds like you've had a bad experience one time in Montenegro, Nima.
But,
I'm joking. Yes, I think this comes down to the major question that I do not, there's almost no discussion of this in most of the media. Simply, why do nations have conflict? Why do they have to go to war? Or how can they avoid going to war? And as I've said earlier, I think this is something as simple as a decision in many ways. I don't want to say everybody in the world is going to get along with everybody else all the time. Of course, there are going to be frictions and differing interests, but there's a big difference between saying we have slightly different interests in this issue, between that on the one hand and going to war on the other. I don't see anything inevitable about this. And this is, by the way, where I criticize John Mearsheimer, for whom I have great regard as an analyst about the Ukraine and Gaza. He's a great analyst. But John also seems to think that because America's big and Russia and China is big, automatically this means mechanically almost that they have to come to blows. I just don't buy that. The countries have choices. And so if a country really wants to go to war, they can certainly find grounds to do it. But the United States has been constantly trying to put this into a black and white, this block versus that kind of block, which, again, is not the nature of the new world, I don't think. The U.S. loves the word allies. The U.S. press always talks about allies, but nobody else talks about allies in quite that sense, in that same sense. So it is a new emerging world, and I'm more positive about the ability of countries to make wise choices rather than choices of hostility. And it's organizations like NATO that help create hostilities. It says to the other side, we consider you the enemy, and we're pulling together all our forces against you. Well, of course, if you're on the receiving end of that, you perceive that as a very hostile statement. But don't forget the Russia took down, dismantled the Warsaw Pact at the end of the war, end of the Cold War. NATO chose not to do that because it liked to have the enemy. I think this is a bit crude and primitive, and maybe goes back to global superpower thinking that's disappearing more and more every day.
Graham, the collapse of the Soviet Union, I think Russia is still dealing with the consequences of the collapse of the Soviet Union. The case of Ukraine is one of them. The ethnic Russians, overnight, they've been separated from Mother Russia. And you see the same in Lithuania, Latvia, all Estonia. And do you think that Vladimir Putin would be able, from whatever would happen with the negotiations between Russia and the United States, would be able to change the situation for ethnic Russians in these countries, in these, because it's so important. We know that the main reason, one of the, I would assume the main reason for the war in Ukraine was the case of ethnic Russians being attacked by the Ukrainian government.
Yes, although I don't think it was anywhere near as important as the movement of NATO right up to Russia's borders. After 25 years of warning from Russia about saying, don't do it, for us, that's a red line. But you raise a very good question here, Nima. And these are latent problems that exist in areas like the Baltic states. I would not want to be in a position to tell the Estonians, don't worry, Russia will never invade you, will never put serious pressure. And nobody can say that because there's a built-in conflict, if you will, in that situation. But it's a manageable problem. If Russia wants to exploit it and to make war against Estonia, they will be able to do it. If Estonia wants to create some tensions and something to I don't know, bring NATO in closer, it could do it. But I don't think that this automatically has to happen. It's a good question. What do you do when you have small minorities in bigger states? It's a difficult problem, and no one has really ever fully solved it. You just hope that these minorities will ultimately be able to peacefully integrate into those bigger societies. But yeah, you raise the question that many are raising still, and there's no easy answer.
And by the way, that's why I would argue that the case of the role of Europe in any sort of Ukrainian settlement is vital. It's so much important to be considered, because after all, the agreement would be between Europe and Russia. It's not the United States. United States can support the deal, can guarantee the deal, but the participants of the deal are Europeans and Russia.
Well, Nima, I'm not sure I agree with you, but I'm divided on this issue. In one sense, I feel, and I'm going to be a bit blunt and perhaps a bit unkind towards Europe. I have lots of European friends. My wife was European, or British anyway. I think the Europeans are still in such a state of shock at the idea that the U.S. is going to be pulling out. And let's not forget, it's not just a question of strategy or military issues. With the creation of NATO, the United States essentially assumed the entire burden. They complained about it, but assumed the entire burden of defense of Europe. And it was a great deal for Europe. And everybody understood that. Europe could spend its money on wonderful social programs and cultural programs and you know, its own industrial things, and didn't have to worry about strategy or military issues. Now they do. Now it's going to cost them much more money. I don't think they have the money for that. I think many European states are going to say, like Greece or something, or Hungary, are going to say, thank you very much, but we don't want to have to pay for all of that because we don't really believe we need it. So I think the Europeans are still troublemakers in this regard and don't know where to go, what their identity is without the United States. So I'm inclined to disagree with you and say, all right, let the US and Russia solve this because the Europeans are going to do nothing but make trouble about it all. On the other hand, you make a very good point that ultimately a real peace, a real, not just a peace, but a real security arrangement that includes all of Europe from, as Gorbachev used to say, from the Ural Mountains to Spain, that would be obviously needed, something that Europe would benefit from greatly. But I think their thinking is still too primitive, too inexperienced to go there. And in the meantime, with bad actors, like especially the UK, who has hated Russia for 300 years, I think it's going to be difficult to include the Europeans very fully in this. It's a time of transition for Europe, painful transition.
Graham, when you talk about Europeans, you talk about the leaders who are currently running the show in Europe, or you're talking about the public opinion as well?
I'm talking about the leadership, which I don't see much real leadership there. There aren't any good serious leaders. Germany has not had serious leadership since Angela Merkel. The Netherlands is in the hands of quite racist politicians, very anti-Muslim movements. France, I'm not sure where France is. France has always been slightly independent. Italy doesn't really want to be fully part of all of this. So I think European leadership is in a crisis, and its present elections seemingly do not represent the will of the public. There's already anxiety in Germany that this new coalition that may come about under Merz formed a coalition just weeks before the elections, which would have changed the balance of power among the German parties. So I think it's very possible that if new elections took place in Germany in a month, or in 6 months, in 1 year, that the public would elect politicians that don't want war, don't want to spend a lot of money on this kind of thing, and are uncomfortable with it. But so Europe itself is in a state of transition. But yeah, I think the leadership is part of the problem.
What does it make so difficult for European countries or public opinion in Europe to change the leadership? In the United States, at least people could elect Donald Trump. And Donald Trump is shaking the foreign policy of the United States. Everyone should, I think many people believe that. But in Europe, you don't get it. In Germany, you look at Germany, you look at United Kingdom, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, Sunak, right now Starmer, they're totally the same. These people are not even a teeny tiny difference between the two, between all of these prime ministers in United Kingdom. And you look at France, the same. Meloni, a little bit, but not that much to be considered. Why are the people, the public opinion, the people who are voting, who do want to change, who do want, we see that in Germany, we see that in France, but you don't see that being interpreted in the presidential election?
It's a very good question, Nima, and I can't really give you a fully adequate answer. Certainly elections will change the shape of European policies over time, especially if new leadership comes in. And that's what I'm very much hoping for. But this is old leadership. It's leadership that's been around, if not the exact same people, but the mentality has been the same for a very long time. And this is such a shock now for them if NATO should come to an end for an economic grounds, how to think about themselves, what is the European identity, how are they going to cooperate militarily? I mean, even interesting questions like the German rearmament. I have great admiration for Germany, and I think they've done an extraordinary job in recreating a modern Germany out of the ashes of the terrible World War II and Nazi Germany. But Germany has always been powerful, and I don't like to say it, but I fear that some countries like Belgium or the Netherlands may have mixed feelings if Germany says we're going to inaugurate a new arms program and we're going to ramp up the German military budget hugely. Okay, if NATO isn't there, maybe they can understand it, but smaller European countries do have some memory of history, and I'm not sure that a super powerful military Germany is something that makes them all entirely comfortable. So there are changes that are going to come about, I think, over time.
Graham, just to wrap up this session, we have two important negotiations going on right now: the United States, Russia; United States, Iran. And in both negotiations, we have the positions. We have Europeans against the new attitude of the Trump administration in Ukraine. We have Netanyahu against Donald Trump in the case of Iran. Which one, in your opinion, if you were to compare, and how much they would influence the talks, which one is more powerful in your opinion?
Well, there's no doubt that any diplomatic victory or accomplishment by Trump will strengthen Trump in any negotiations anywhere. This is just a reality. So if he really does bring about a serious peaceful agreement in Europe, I think this would make it harder for Bibi Netanyahu perhaps to oppose him. But it won't stop Bibi. Bibi has his own deep personal interests in all of this. So I think you raise an interesting question as to the interrelationship between these two problems. I'm not sure I would be able to answer that very clearly. In one sense, the Iranian problem is simpler, in that really just involves the United States and Iran, and of course Israel, but I think maybe Israel can be dealt with by Washington a little more easily. And by the way, I think we see growing discomfort with the role of Israel in American politics. It's becoming much more open now, specific. I mean, guys like John Mearsheimer are saying that that Israel is a liability, a net liability to American politics. We see even now many Jewish organizations becoming nervous about this huge push now in the U.S. to fight anti-Semitism. I think a lot of Americans and a lot of even universities and things say, well, wait a minute, yes, there probably is some anti-Semitism, but, you know, this is being pushed so hard that even some moderate Jewish organizations in the U.S. are getting a little bit uncomfortable with this. It can almost create its own kind of anti-Semitism. So I think if I were Trump, I probably would rather deal with Bibi and even the Jewish lobby, which does not have the united support of all Jews by any means. I think I would have a chance there of a more solid peace Russia would help, China would help, as opposed to dealing with Europe, which is dealing with nations that are really very uncomfortable with the whole situation, that don't necessarily have a strong sense of identity, that are divided, ideologically divided, and you're going to have to bring, you know, 21 countries or whatever all together if they're going to have a really long-term peace settlement. That's probably even more difficult to do. But you know, I wish Trump well. He doesn't play by the rule books, and that maybe gives me some hope, because the way the old system was working was not working.
Thank you so much, Graham, for being with us today.
My pleasure,
great
Nima.
Pleasure, as always.
Well, thank you. You have always great questions. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.